Welcome again to everyone. This is the second case set for argument today, Justin Freelove versus Lindsay Freelove, case 82732-COA. I'm Michael Gibbons, Chief Judge, joined by Judge Bonnie Bola and Judge Deborah Westbrook. You heard all of our talk after the last case, counsel, and it's hopefully going to indulge us a little bit with all the extra comments we had in the pictures and everything. It's a special occasion. Not that this isn't special, too. It is, but that was the first one. So, Judge Bola, do you have any comments before we start?
Well, welcome. Thank you both for being willing to participate in the pro bono project and accept a pro bono case. It's important to both the bench and the bar that we continue to support those in our community that need the services. So thank you both.
Judge Westbrook.
And again, I'll echo what Judge Bola said. Thank you so much for your hard work in this case. And I just have to say the briefing in this particular appeal was excellent on both sides. I was really excited to see the briefs, and I'm letting my staff know that this is exemplary briefing. So that, you know, what you guys did was great.
Okay. And that was stated by a former appellate attorney who wrote hundreds of briefs. All right. So the appellant here is Justin Freelove and represented by Mr. Nobrega. And the counsel, would you like to reserve any time for rebuttal?
3 minutes, please, Your Honor.
3 minutes. Okay. And also for the record, we have Mr. Davis representing the respondent, Lindsay Freelove. This is an appeal from an order from the district court in Washoe County. We're hearing this case in Clark County. Typically, we hear the cases where they originate, but because this is through the pro bono program, then we're doing it here in Las Vegas. So that was a concession on our part to make it convenient for counsel. I'm assuming you're both practicing in Las Vegas?
Yes.
Okay. All right. So we did make some concession there to make it a little easier for you. You don't want to be like that. You heard Mr. Jones on the last case says he's had one going on for 8 years or something that's in the pro bono program.
Wow.
All right, Mr. Nobrega, you may proceed, and the 3 minutes are.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. My name is William Nobrega, and I represent the appellant, Mr. Justin Freelove, in this matter. This case boils down to the district court's refusal to actually consider the regulatory formula when determining whether Mr. Freelove's request for modification was valid, because it inexplicably determined that Mr. Freelove's income had not changed by 20% or more. This action has led to three substantive errors that mandate reversal and remand to the district court to correct. First, the factual finding that Mr. Freelove's income has not changed by 20% or more is clearly erroneous, and frankly, it's inexplicable how the district court came up with that finding. Mr. Freelove's income changed by 32%. Ms. Freelove doesn't challenge this in the answering brief, and she didn't challenge it in the court below. Second, if there was a substantive review, meaning if this court buys Ms. Freelove's argument that the district court, courtmaster, attempted to engage in a substantive review, that review fails for two reasons. One, the district court's order does not contain any factual findings as to the regulatory factors needed to set or modify child support. It doesn't talk about Mr. Freelove's income and the base amount that's presumptively what he should pay under Nevada law, nor does it give any reasons under the regulatory factors why the court deviated by $200 over the base amount by retaining the same modification amount that was originally set. But second, even if this court tries to look toward the transcript, which is what Ms. Freelove's attorney is going to get up here and say, you should look at the transcript. That doesn't matter because the district court didn't actually engage with these factors at all. He focuses on the fact that it had only been 1 year since the initial child support order was set, and he focused on the fact that Mr. Freelove was, quote unquote, relitigating issues in the previous order. Third, the district court erred by sua sponte assessing interest and penalties on arrears from November 2019 until April 2020. November 2019 order, Mr. Freelove contends he had no notice of. It was never served on him. And as Ms. Freelove helpfully supplemented the record, to show that he did receive the April 2020 modified order. After that modified order was sent to Mr. Freelove, he almost immediately began paying the child support amount, but he had no notice of the initial setting of child support. And to assess interest and penalties on it violates his constitutional right to due process. Mr. Freelove has the right to be notified of the obligations he has to pay to Ms. Freelove. Moving to the first error, the factual.
Let me ask you a factual question first, Mr. Nobrega. I know you weren't counsel below. But the record on this case, though, is to me, it's in large part what we don't have versus what we do have. Yes, we have a transcript. We have an order. We have a few things in there. But isn't it really odd that you have a hearing and there's nothing in the record about what happened after the original hearing? What was served on whom? I mean, there's no certificate of service. I mean, wasn't there a lawyer at some point below? What doesn't counsel serve? I mean, you know, what's going on in this case that it appears irregular, that we don't have things that we normally would see?
So part of that irregularity, Mr. Chief Judge, is that the posture of this case didn't just start with the motion for modification of child support. It started with the motion to assess arrears and to get the arrears from Mr. Freelove. So the DA actually instituted the case by trying to go after Mr. Freelove for the amount that he owed, because he didn't have notice of that.
But it started before that with the custody aspect of the case and the relocation.
Right, yeah. So it started obviously with the divorce way back when, and then with the relocation, and then with the child support order being amended. But the posture of this case, in starting with that motion, the district attorney didn't attach all of the things to the motion for modification right away. So that's why we have some gaps in the record as to what was served on whom, and we tried to reconstruct that the best we can with the record that we had.
But wasn't Mr. Freelove paying child support earlier on in the proceedings, even if they had joint custody?
No, Your Honor. My understanding from the record is that he wasn't paying child support. He had joint custody, and they were making almost equal income because they had the same job at the prison. Okay. They both worked at
but
the prison.
He was aware of the fact that the custodial parent would receive child support. If he moves to Idaho, he's going to have to pay child support because the child's in Nevada.
Right, but he didn't have notice of the underlying entry of the order. So he knew that the case was pending, and at one point he had a lawyer, and one point Ms. Freelove had a lawyer, but he never actually got notice of the underlying entry.
So you can be willfully blind then?
No, Your Honor, I wouldn't characterize it that way. I think that someone has to have notice of the finality of the proceeding going on. So oftentimes, you know, as this court knows, in the district court, case is penned, you wait for the entry of an order. The second judicial district's obviously a little different because they tend to write their own orders as opposed to waiting for counsel to do it. But, you know, you have to have some sort of finality of when the district court order is actually entered. So litigants, I think, oftentimes wait for the district court to enter an order that starts their obligation, right?
And so certainly you need that to know the specifics. But if you leave the state, I mean, wouldn't anyone in that position know that, I no longer have custody, I'm going to have to pay support?
Yeah, of course, Your Honor. Yeah, they would. They would have to know that. But I think what Mr. Freelove was waiting for here was a final order that set the actual amount that he was going to have to pay. And it hadn't been that long. It had been 5 months since the order was entered to when he got actual notice of it. So it's
all right. Yeah. Well, I took you a little bit out of the order of your organized argument, which was very organized in your introduction. So I'll let you go back to it unless my colleagues are going to keep you out of that organization. But you started with the 20% and you said that was clearly erroneous. Now, the statute doesn't explicitly say the court has to use the 20% to determine the child support, only that a hearing has to be held. And in common practice, if you have a 20% change, you're probably going to get a modification. So yeah, this does seem out of the norm, but it's not literally the statute that you have to get a modification.
Right, Your Honor. So that's moving into my second point. So we'll just work backward from the third to the second, and then I'll touch on the first. I think the first is the strongest one, though. So I hope I'll be able to get back to it. To the second point, I think that goes to what a substantive review actually is. And luckily, the Nevada Supreme Court in Rivero actually touched on what a substantive review should look like. The Supreme Court in Rivero says, and I'll get the exact language. When considering a modification motion, the district court will always consider the same factual circumstances, those specified in NRS 125B070 and 080. Now, those factual circumstances, those are the modification factors under the Nevada Administrative Code. They've been recodified. So what the Rivero court intended when talking about what a substantive review looks like is you have a changed circumstance, or you have a motion that's presented. And in this case, you have changed circumstances already determined by statute. 20% or more is deemed changed circumstances. So what the Rivero court would like the district court to do is then go through the modification factors and see if a modification is warranted. So you look at the base child support amount, and then you look at the circumstances outlined in, if you're inclined, if the district court's inclined to modify from that base child support amount, in this case of $554, it's got to look at these, it's got to look at the deviation factors in NAC 1.50, NAC 425150, to determine whether or not it can deviate upward. So while Rivero does say that you don't have to have a modification, you're correct, Your Honor, it does say that they have to go through these factors. Those factual circumstances have to be considered again. And the district court could ultimately determine, frankly, that Mr. Freelove's change in circumstances don't warrant a modification, even though they had that substantive review. But what it has to do then is explain to Mr. Freelove in written findings why it's deviating upward by $200 by remaining from the presumptive amount by keeping the child support the same.
So are you saying the problem here is not making the factual findings using those considerations when deciding should modification be done?
And that kind of, if I can go to the first point just briefly, that's the district court only found that there wasn't a change in circumstances. If you look at the cover sheet in the appendix, he says there's not a change in circumstances of 20% or more. But it's indisputable. It's indisputable that his income changed by 32%. And then it says in the actual order, there's not sufficient changes of circumstances warranting modification. But there's no actual factual findings at all in the written order that show that he's actually analyzed these factors and gone through and done that work necessary to keep the child support exactly the same and decline to modify the child support.
But is there evidence in the record that the modification of a child support order would reduce Mr. Freelove's monthly child support obligation in light of the downward deviations he received in the initial support decree?
Yeah, so, and that's what's so troublesome about this order, Your Honor. So yes, I believe that there is, unless there's some sort of, unless some of these factors the district court finds should go against him, because in the original decree, his maximum child support amount was $800 per month. The court deviated downwards $50 per month for insurance and then gave an optional deviation for every month that he went from Idaho into Nevada. He could reduce it by 250 more. So that's a $300 downward deviation from the base child support amount. But here, Mr. Freelove's income goes down by 32%. His presumptive base child support amount is $550. And he's still paying $750, and he doesn't get any of the downward even if you account for the downward deviations, he only goes down to about $500. Why do those downward deviations not stay in place given the reduction in his income?
So you're really concerned about the base amount?
Yeah, the base amount should be considered. And if the court wants to, Your Honor, deviate from that by $200, if it wants to go up to $750 and then keep those deviations in place, it needs to make factual findings as to that. And needs to do it in a written order so these cases can be properly reviewed on appeal. Because when you look at the transcript, frankly, candidly, none of us were in the room when that hearing was going on. Mm-hmm. None of us listened to it. So we're trying to psychologize what the court master did in making his findings. It's nearly impossible. The record's very jumbled, and it's hard to tell what he's considering and what he's brushing off because Mr. Freelove isn't making proper legal arguments and why he keeps focusing on 1 year when 1 year is not a consideration he should be making at all. So, yeah, there needs to be factual findings. Judge, I'm sorry.
And, no, it's fine. What about the fact of the child support arrears? Couldn't that be factored into to cause an upward deviation?
It perhaps could. If this court's not inclined, if they're inclined to go with what Chief Judge Gibbons says and believe that this is just willful ignorance of the child support amount, I suppose that if you're counting the arrears, you could count it as some form of upward deviation.
Is there evidence in the record? Isn't that I mean, the district attorney was asking for that, correct?
The district,
like a $50 a month child support arrears increase.
Yes, Your Honor. The district attorney mentioned that. Yes, yes.
Is it possible that that factored into the district court's determination that circumstances, maybe the amounts of money, wouldn't change based on the review? So let's just keep it the same?
Let me qualify this. It's absolutely possible that that's what the district court did. But again, it's very unclear. So district court, if you read through the transcript, which I'm sure you all have, but if you read through the transcript hypothetically and you go through it and you see all of a sudden they're talking back and forth, everyone's talking to each other. It's after Mr. Freelove was put under oath. And the district court says something like, well, when I figure all this in, your child support should go up to 779. And you wonder, well, where do you get that number? It goes up $29 from what it was before. Or where is it coming from? And it's hard to tell where it's coming from.
But if the court did undertake some kind of analysis, I mean, is it fair to say that the court didn't conduct the review required if they reached a number that the court felt was not, or I'm sorry, the hearing master felt was not, wouldn't be a change in dollar value?
Respectfully, Your Honor, I don't think it's enough. And this goes into Ms. Freelove's argument territory where she says, well, we saw the transcript, they had a hearing, and then they went through and kind of talked about things, they went back and forth, and therefore they considered all the factors. If you look at the court master's response to several Mr. Freelove's argument, frankly, it was just dismissive. Well, what's your legal argument for that? Oh, I thought we were talking about this, but now we're talking about that. You're relitigating these issues. I don't think that rises to the level of what the Nevada Supreme Court anticipated in Rivero. And that's a disciplined analysis of the presumptive base child support amount. And if they're going to deviate specific factual findings under which factors that require the deviation and a finding for the best interest of the child, none of which really occurred in the transcript. So it's not enough. And frankly, it's not enough just to have a hearing because every single modification request is set for a hearing under NRS 425383. Every single one, regardless of if there's been sufficient change circumstances of 20% or more, whether it's a three-year review, they're all set for a hearing. So just having a hearing can't be enough to make it a mandatory review. Otherwise, the distinction between permissive and mandatory wouldn't make sense in Rivera.
All right, you better stop now before you run out of time.
Yes,
Eldo. We'll set it at 2 minutes for the rebuttal because of the extra questions there. Good questions, but extra questions. So we have Mr. Davis appearing for Ms. Freelove.
Absolutely.
And I know you're going to start off talking about something that Mr. Nobrega didn't even mention.
Actually, good afternoon, Your Honors, Mr. Chief Judge, judges of this court. My name is Stephen Davis, and I represent the respondent in this matter, Lindsay Winkles. The district court's order should be affirmed for three reasons. First, the district court did consider the merits of the matter, and I think that is the meat and potatoes of where we're at. We'll talk about waiver, which is the big elephant in the room here momentarily. But despite what appellant's attorney is telling you, when you go back and you consider the entire record, you see the judge talking about deviations and whether or not they should be considered and additional costs and things like that. It was clear that he had the Rivero factors in mind. He was going through those and he was considering them. Nor was the master required to make specific findings of fact under NAC 425-150 subsection 1. That's required when you deviate upwards or downwards from the statutory requirement.
But what about Rivero?
Well, I think you have to keep Rivero's factors in mind, and you have to consider them. But when you're refusing to modify a child support order, I don't think that either the NAC or Rivero requires you to put forth those specific facts. The judge is required to have a hearing. He's required to go through the factors on the record. But I don't see anything in Nevada law that would require him to state those specific facts if he denies a motion to modify.
Well, in fact, Rivero In that case, the parent had moved to modify child support, mm-hmm. and the court said that in denying Ms. Rivera child support, the district court relied on the divorce decree in which the parties agreed that neither would receive child support. In this case, the district court erred by not making specific findings of fact regarding whether Ms. Rivera was entitled to receive child support under NRS Chapter 125B and explaining any deviations from the statutory formulas. So it seems under the plain language of Rivera that those factual findings need to be made.
I apologize, Your Honor. I don't have Rivera immediately in front of me in hand. So the our position would be that we do not, that does not have to be made. And I don't remember Rivera's for a specific procedural history. So my apologies.
Okay, no, that's fine. I mean, Rivera obviously was decided when the statute NRS 125B080 and those statutory sections contained the legal requirements for modifying. Correct. Now we have the administrative code. I'm wondering, are there differences in the language in the administrative code between, that were in effect at the time Rivera was decided and currently that might, I guess, suggest that we look to the language of the code, the plain language as you've indicated?
I mean, just looking at the plain language of the code right now, Your Honor, it only says, and let me find it specifically here, it says that any child support obligation may be adjusted by the court in accordance with the specific needs of the child and the economic circumstances of the parties based upon the following factors and specific findings of fact. The modification of the child support obligation. The child support obligation was not modified here. There was an existing order that was already set in place. And then what happened is the appellant moved to modify the order. That order, after a full hearing and after evidence was entertained, was denied. There was no need to set out specific facts according to the plain language of NAC 425-150 subsection 1. It doesn't require that. The legislature or the promulgating agency could have easily put that in there and said, if whenever there's been a significant change of circumstances of 20% or more, then in either granting or denying the motion, the district court must set forth the specific factors that are articulated in 150 subsection 1. But that's not in there. He's reading something into the NAC, Your Honor, that just does not exist. Yes.
Just so, go ahead.
Really quick, this analogizing that to child custody cases, because we see these appeals constantly about the factors for child custody, and the decisions are almost uniform. The district court has to apply the factors if it modifies or does not modify child custody and determine best interest. Is that, I won't call it an outlier, maybe this is an outlier, the child support part. How would you put those two together? So in child custody, you have to have the factors no matter what the decision is. And as a general support, as a general rule, I guess I can't say that 100%, as a general rule.
Mm-hmm. In child custody, whenever it's changed, or whenever someone brings it up, we're dealing with the custody of the child. We're dealing with the child going with one parent, both parents, the other parent. This is not that. This is child support modification. This is something that's money. This is something that is to provide for the child. This is something that has already been heard and decided by a court. Maybe have gone through appeal. And now it's another party moving to modify. And when that happens, and we take a look at NAC 425-150 subsection 1. There is no requirement in plain language to set out the modification of the list of those factors.
How about all the Nevada Supreme Court cases that say, well, we have to have findings, otherwise there's not a meaningful appellate review?
And that's where we get into another factor here, Your Honor, and the one that you were alluding to a little bit earlier, which is this could have been resolved at the district court level had appellant objected to the district court or to the special master's findings and recommendations in the first process or in the first instance. And what happens is because they didn't, we enter into this situation of where you have three essentially different parts of the Nevada statute coming together that makes the district court go ahead and enter this order, which is you have NRS 3.405 subsection 4 that says if you don't file an objection, the court shall accept the findings of fact unless clearly erroneous. And then you go to 425.3844 subsection 3, which says the recommendation entered by the master shall be deemed approved if there's no objection, which means that now you're down into same subsection 7 that says a copy of the upon approval by the district court of the recommendation entered by the master, which the master does not, or the district court has no option now because there's been no objection. A copy of the recommendation with the approval of the court endorsed thereon must be filed. The court doesn't have the district court doesn't have a choice of that. It's got to do that.
But Mr. Davis, if the district court approves the hearing master's recommendation, that doesn't prevent a party from appealing that recommendation to a higher court, does it?
No, but what it does do, well, let me take a step back, Your Honor. We're not saying that their appeal is jurisdictionally defective. What we're saying is that they've waived their arguments, that they had to object to the district court's, or to the, excuse me, special master's finding and recommendations in the first instance in order to fix the issue down below before it comes up for appeal.
What if they don't think it's fixable below? What if they just decide, let's just appeal the decision? It doesn't prevent them from doing that. In fact, if the district court signs off on the recommendations, the district court then has to live with the ramifications of the approval of that recommendation. Wouldn't that be correct?
No, Your Honor, I don't think it would be. And here's the reason why, and I'm going to take that statement, I'm going to work backwards.
Okay.
That the district court has to live with it, with the findings and recommendations. The problem is the Nevada statutes don't give the district court any discretion in this matter, other than if the factual findings are clearly erroneous. It says, you didn't object, therefore, Mr. District Court Judge, you must enter them, and they must be filed.
But that doesn't prevent a party from appealing that decision as it stands based on the approval of the district court to a higher court, particularly under Saragusa, I believe it is.
Yeah, and I want to address Saragusa in just a moment. But I think that's why it's important to differentiate the right of appeal versus the waiver of the arguments. And I think it's you know, along a situation of where if a party doesn't bring up an objection is a good example, you know, then it waives its right to have that objection, to assert that objection on appeal. These arguments, they have to continue to assert them, and the next step in asserting that is to object to the district court. And once they object to the district court, then the district court can step in, hold a hearing, and or fix the order.
But if the district court does not step in and just simply approves it, which can happen, independent of whether or not someone objects. I mean, a party might object to the district court's decision, and the district court may still enter the order and approve it, just as it's written by the hearing master in this particular case.
Absolutely.
That doesn't foreclose a party from bringing an appeal on the very issues contained in that order, does it?
Again, it does not prevent them from filing an appeal, but I think it does waive their issues, Your Honor. Now, Mr. Nobringa has talked about potentially it be plain error review or something along those lines. We would assert that it's waived. But in this particular situation, it was that failure to object that prevented the district court from fixing this in the first instance. And otherwise, what you have in regards to judicial efficiency is situations to where people may make the decision not to object, come up to this court, delay the proceedings, and then have it be sent back down. And as painful as that may be, that's the way how it should be set up, because a party must continue to assert their objections. They must be timely. We see many rights being waived if you don't comply with the timelines and what have you, objections and discovery, so on and so forth. That may absolutely hinge and change how a case turns out.
So how do you address Saragusa?
Saragusa had to deal with 125, and Your Honor, that had to deal with the referee for smaller counties. And we think that just, it's not controlling. It certainly does appear persuasive, but we don't think it is, because it has to deal with the referees, has to deal with child custody, has to deal with divorces, and it has to deal with the smaller counties. So we would assert that when it comes to situations like this, that the real concern about Saragusa was the Nevada Supreme Court didn't want to give up the opportunity to overturn a bad situation as a result of with kids or something along those lines. And here, this is just about money.
Wasn't it alimony in Saragusa?
It was alimony. Yes, it was, Your Honor.
So alimony money is different from child support money?
No, but this is a situation of where if it's just involved with money rather than arguing the entire 125, I think that we would limit ours and sit there and say that it should be waived because he had to object in the first point, and it doesn't have to deal with these weighty monumental issues of children, custody, you know, lives on the line.
I just wanted to clarify one of the facts. I want to make sure that it's not a disputed fact that Mr. Freelove's monthly income was reduced 32.8% based on the new job he obtained from moving to, I believe it was Idaho.
Our understanding is there is nothing in the record that contradicts that. Okay. Now, two other quick points, Your Honor, because I see that my time is running short. Appellant appoints to this front page of an order, and it's really not even a front page to a form order. It's found on JA 82 that says denying motion. The previous order is only a year old, and there are not significant changes of 20% or more. This is a situation of where we believe those are the clerk's notes. If you turn over the page to JA 83, it shows the exhibits there. It wasn't an entered court order. It's certainly not the appealable order. When we go back to the actual appealable order, Your Honor, what we see is we see that the special master clearly specifies, and it shows that he understands what his obligations under Rivera are. A court has discretion to modify a child support order at any time if there are sufficient change circumstances. The court does not find there has been a significant change of circumstances warranting a modification of the child support order at this time. Obliger, the appellant, appeared to want to relitigate some of the issues that were resolved in that order, such as travel expenses and child care expenses. And so I think it's an inartful use of the phrase, Your Honors. I don't think that the special master was saying there hadn't been a 20% change or more. I think what he was saying is when I consider all of these factors that we talked about at the hearing, I don't find that there's enough change in circumstances for me to grant the motion. What not else, that he couldn't hear.
What else could there be? I mean, somebody has a new job and is making a lot less money. I mean, it's hard to imagine a scenario other than this case where there was or wasn't. I mean, it's more than 30%.
Mm-hmm.
Does it have to be 40, 50? What if it was 80% and we're arguing this? Would that finding still stand?
I think that's exactly why we entrust these decisions and go with abuse of discretion, Your Honor, because they have to weigh each individual fact. And here we have the change in an appellant's income, but let's not change the fact that there were costs in child care. There were the travel charges. There was the cost of health insurance. There was the cost of visitation. All of these were discussed in the hearing, Your Honor. And I think that I would be loath to draw a bright line at 32% or 40% or 50% and take that discretion away from either the master or the district court judge.
Well, maybe the master was influenced by that dramatic deviation that was given of $250 for visits to go see the child. Apparently they never happened, but I know Ms. Freelove challenged it and she lost. It seemed really strange the way that unfolded, but I'm just trying to find where in the record justifies the master's conclusion. If you put it all together like you're suggesting, I mean, take the whole thing together, what makes it stand out that this was not a significant change of circumstance out of any of the circumstances here?
My time's expired. May I respond, Your Honor?
Okay, sorry, I kept you going on that. So we already gave some extra time to Mr. Nobrega, so go ahead.
So in the transcript, they go through each of these items, and we cite them specifically in our brief. I'm sorry, Your Honor, I'm trying to keep this brief and not run on very long. And so where he does talk about these different costs, these different changes in the transcripts, and then what happens is he gets to the end of that order and he says, well, you know, the parties are just trying to keep portions of the previous order and tailor things, change other parts of the order. So he was going to deny it. And that falls squarely within his discretion here.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much, Mr. Davis.
Thank you, Your Honor. Appreciate it.
There's a lot to cover, Mr. Nobrega, so I'm not going to interrupt. I don't know about my colleagues.
Yeah, there is. I'm just going to pick up right where Mr. Davis said left off. I mean, I don't envy his position. It's like I said, it's nearly impossible from the transcript to see what change of circumstances, what didn't change besides the income. The income went down. He still lives in Idaho. He still pays for the insurance. He still has plans to go see his son in Nevada. Nothing else changed but the income. So it's hard to see why there wasn't a change in circumstances when the threat, when the income was so drastically dropped. Addressing Judge Westbrook's point on the language of the new NAC, if you read NAC 150, it says any child support obligation already in place, any child support obligation may be adjusted by the court in accordance with specific needs of the child and the economic circumstances of the party based on the following factors and specific findings of fact. So that pretty much indicates that you need to have specific findings of fact. Nothing changed between that and Rivera. And then I just want to talk briefly about the waiver rule. I think Zaragoza defeats it on its face. I understand that Mr. Davis tried to distinguish it based on the smaller county aspect of it and the alimony. On the smaller county aspect, that statute applied at the time of that case to all counties. That was only added in 1991 where it applied to smaller counties, and they started using these court masters in the larger counties. So that distinguishing factor fails. As for the distinguishing between alimony and child support, I understand the public policy behind child support. It's to provide the support to the child that the parent can provide. So I think that Justice Pickering's opinion for the court in Fernandez is really clear here. She says, more fundamentally, neither our statutes nor public policy supports the argument that more court-ordered child support is always better for the child than less. It's not. And as a result, and it says, the deviation factors, I'm quoting again, are designed not to produce the highest award possible, but rather a child support order that is adequate for the child's needs, fair to both parents, and set at levels that can be met without impoverishing the obligor parent or requiring that enforcement and machinery be deployed. If Mr. Freelip has to continue paying this amount, the machinery of enforcement is going to be deployed. He can't afford it. His income was decreased. So for those reasons, we think it should be reversed. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Nobrega and Mr. Davis. Excellent job by both counsel. And then we'll take this matter under submission for a written decision in the near future. Anything else, Judge Bullock?
Thank you both very much for your excellent arguments.
Excellent. Thank you.